my life, knowing that I'd had immortality and unlimited wealth in my hands before you all took it away. Now I'm back to get even, and you expect me to pitch underhand? You're all trapped in a deadly game that I have spent years dreaming up. Jeff died because I needed to kill someone at the outset so that you'd know what the stakes are.
We're time travelers, Tyler said. We'll figure out a way to get Jeff back.
Todd looked directly at Tyler. If you survive to get your powers back, which Jeff didn't. You wanted a reason to be emotionally involved? Well, now you have one. You have to keep going, or you'll be killed. If you fail to complete any of the challenges, you will be killed. If you get careless and make a mistake along the way, you will be killed.
But you need to keep us alive to play this crappy game of yours out to the end, Tyler said.
I don't know. Ideally, that'd be for the best, but really, if you all die miserably, then the game has served its purpose. I already know how it ends anyway. I made it. Besides, Tyler, just because I expect someone to make it to the end doesn't mean that I expect you to make it. The fact is, I really only wanted revenge on Philip, Jimmy, and Gary. You and Jeff are here because I knew you were their friends. I figured watching you two die would spur them on.
You're saying I'm expendable, Tyler said.
The opposite, Todd explained. If someone's expendable, you don't mind if they die. I expect you to die. I don't know if there's a word for that. Maybe sacrifice. Except that I won't be sorry when you're gone. And by the way, a little way up the trail, you'll find a dead hunting party that you can loot for warm clothes and weapons. It's nothing fancy, just some swords, shields, and animal skins. Should help you fight off the cold and the mountain wolves.
What killed the hunting party? Tyler asked.
Todd said, mountain wolves.
Jimmy said, that doesn't speak well for the effectiveness of the weapons.
No, it doesn't.
Todd agreed, a little too enthusiastically.
What if we refuse? Philip asked. What if we just sit here and wait for you to give up?
Well, you'll either freeze to death or be eaten by mountain wolves. I still get my revenge.
Philip asked,
and what happens if we make it to the end of your quest?
To the chasm of certain doom? Well, you'll learn the identity of the Chosen One. The man who will be free,
Todd answered.
One man, Philip said.
If any of you make it to the chasm at all,
Todd said. Jimmy said,
so the choice you're offering us is to not cooperate and be killed, or to cooperate and probably be killed.
Yes, Todd answered.
That's not a lot of incentive, Jimmy said.
Todd said, it's enough.
6. Gwen, Martin, and Roy materialized outside the door to Britt's quarters. They were in a long hallway carved from immaculate, opaque white glass, with a floor of textured, non-slip white glass and walls lined with doors made of off-white glass, for contrast.
Eesh, Roy said. I'm inside. It's the middle of the night, and I feel like I need sunglasses. Which Brit is this we're visiting again?
It was a wise question to ask. Brit was unique in that there was more than one of her. If most people's lives form a straight line extending into the future, Brit's formed a loop. At this moment, past Brit and future Brit were sharing the same time and place, and they were doing so with all the grace of two siblings sharing the back seat on a long car trip. Brit the elder was Brit the younger's older self. She remembered everything that ever happened to Brit the younger, and never let Brit the younger forget it. Brit the younger was Brit the elder's younger self. She resented having to share her existence, and never let Brit the Elder forget it.
Gwen said, "This is Britt the Younger's place. She and Philip are close. She'll want to know if he's in trouble."
Neither Martin nor Roy needed to be told this. Philip and Britt the Younger had been quite open about their relationship, and Britt had visited Ledchurch on more than one occasion. Really, Gwen made the statement not so much for their benefit as for her own. She wanted to reassure herself that they were doing the right thing. It was quite late at night. Britt would be asleep, and Gwen hated to wake her with bad news. Gwen had barely rung the doorbell when the door swung open. Britt's housekeeper, Nick, opened the door. He looked well, as slim and as tan as ever. Nick had been seriously injured a few years ago, but had made a full recovery, and now you'd never know anything had happened. Nick was wearing a baggy white nightshirt instead of his usual uniform, but he smiled and said, "Ah, hello, come in. They've been expecting you." Britt's main room was as Martin remembered it, sleek, beautiful, and free from clutter. Everything in the room, like almost everything in Atlantis, was made of molecularly pure, toughened glass, or for structural elements that needed the extra strength, diamond. One entire wall was a curved, seamless window with a view of the ocean outside. They were well below the surface, but at this time of night, the only fish visible were the ones that came close enough to reflect the light from the apartment. Britt the Elder and Britt the Younger sat on the couch, looking identical, yet completely dissimilar. Britt the Elder looked as cool and crisp as fresh celery. She wore a simple white tunic and contrasting black slacks that matched the frames of her glasses. Her shoulder-length red hair was impeccably styled. Sitting next to her, Britt the Younger had on a baggy sweatshirt, shorts, and a pair of oversized wool socks. Her shoulder-length red hair looked a mess, and her glasses were slightly askew. She clearly had just been pulled out of bed and was not happy about it. Gwen said,
"We thought you'd be alone."
"Yeah,"
Britt the Younger said.
"So did I. I'd settled in to read myself to sleep, and then she showed up, saying I was about to have company, but she wouldn't tell me who or why."
Britt the Elder patted the Younger on the knee and said,
"It was important that you be awake to receive our visitors. Gwen, Martin, always a pleasure. It's good to see you again too, Roy."
Roy said, "I'm sorry, miss. I met the other Britt a couple of times, but I don't believe we've... Oh, yeah, right."
Britt the Elder said,
"Mm-hmm. Anyway, please make yourselves comfortable. We have important news to discuss."
Britt the Younger said,
"This is my home. I'll play hostess, thanks."
Britt the Elder said,
"Of course. I'm sorry. It's just hard because this used to be my place, back when I was you. In fact, I still have this couch. It's an antique now, of course."
Nick entered from the next room with a dining room chair that, while beautiful, looked far less comfortable than the other two available chairs. Roy insisted on taking it, despite the fact that Nick had placed it closer to Gwen, and Gwen had already started to sit on it. Once everyone was comfortable, Britt the Younger looked to Gwen and asked,
"What's up?"
Britt the Elder said,
"They're here to tell you that Philip has been abducted."
Britt the Younger's eyes darted from Gwen's face to Martin's and back.
"What? Is that true?"
"Yes,"
Britt the Elder said.
"He and his friends, Tyler, Jeff, and Gary. Oh, and Jimmy, too."
"When?"
Britt the Younger asked, still looking to Gwen and Martin. Britt the Elder said,
"A little over an hour ago." "That's right, isn't it?"
Martin said,
"Yeah, a little over."
"Who did this?"
Britt the Younger asked.
"They don't know yet,"
Britt the Elder answered. Martin said,
"We think maybe Jimmy."
"But they don't know yet,"
Britt the Elder repeated. Britt the Younger turned to glare at Britt the Elder.
"Yet? So you know who did it?"
"Yes."
"Who?"
Britt the Elder rolled her eyes.
"Dear, you know I can't tell you about the future. You need to experience it for yourself, the way I did."
"But you were just telling me about the future just now. I was asking them questions, and you kept telling me how they were going to answer,"
Britt the Younger said, without ever unclenching her teeth.
"No. See, They're here now, so by telling you what they were going to say, I wasn't telling you about the future. I was telling you about the present.
Britt the Younger said,
Fine.
But it didn't sound like she meant it.
Philip's gone now, so who has him?
Britt the Elder shook her head.
See, that's the problem. Philip's gone in the present, but you don't find out who took him until the future.
Britt the Younger pointedly looked away from Britt the Elder and back to Gwen.
Do you think Philip's in danger?
Britt the Elder said,
Don't be silly, dear. Of course he's in danger. His file settings have been restored to their defaults. He's in grave danger.
Britt the Younger closed her eyes, took a deep breath, then continued addressing Gwen.
Where is he? Do you know?
Britt the Elder started to say something, but Britt the Younger held up a finger and said,
Shh!
Britt the Elder pursed her lips, but remained silent. Gwen said,
Their location parameters have been replaced with a call out to an external program that we haven't been able to access yet. We don't know where they are, and any time we try to make a change to their file, it doesn't take. The external program is preventing us from tampering with anyone in its system.
Britt the Younger sat back and thought for a moment, then said,
So, what do we do?
Martin, Gwen, and Roy all looked at one another, but none of them spoke. Britt the Elder raised a hand and said,
If I may? Go ahead.
Britt the Younger sighed. Britt the Elder cleared her throat.
Gwen would like to research the problem. She suspects that in time we might find the external program and nullify it. Roy, on the other hand, feels very strongly that Philip and his friends are in danger right now, and that the best course is to reset all of your location settings to the call-out for the external program, so that you'll go wherever they are and can help them.
Roy said, Damn straight.
Then he quickly glanced at both Britt and Gwen and said,
Pardon my French, ladies.
Gwen said,
Your French is fine, Roy, but your idea sounds really dangerous.
Britt the Younger said,
I agree. That's a terrible risk to take.
Roy explained,
Maybe, but so is sitting around studying the problem. Our buddies are being threatened. We have to act. Besides, whoever did this was expecting to only get the 5 people they took. They won't expect us. We'll have the advantage, especially if we still have our powers.
But the program, whatever it is, seems to reset wizards to their defaults, Gwen said. What makes you think you'll hold on to your powers?
Britt the Elder said,
As I remember, Martin has an idea about that.
Roy smirked at Martin. Gwen glared at him. Martin said,
Well, I was thinking, what if I carried a copy of the Lead Church Shell program and the Atlantis interface running on my smartphone? I mean, it's not like running the file itself, but both of those programs modify the file through a simplified interface. So I figure if we're running them on a machine that we take with us, it should counteract whatever the other program is doing.
Roy slapped Martin on the back.
Good idea, kid.
Yes,
Britt the Elder said.
It will be interesting for you to see if it works.
Britt the Younger said,
Will? You said it will be interesting. I suppose that means that we're going, doesn't it?
Britt the Elder frowned.
I shouldn't have said that. I guess I've let the cat out of the bag. I might as well tell you. You'll try in vain to ferret out and neutralize this mysterious program, but after a day of intense effort and no progress, you will decide to try Roy's foolhardy idea. I'll send you on your way. While you are, wherever you're going, trying to save the 3 of them.
5,
Martin said.
5 of them are gone.
Britt the Elder smiled.
Sorry, my mistake. Anyway, while you're away, the plan is that I stay here and continue to try to get access to that external program.
That's the plan?
Britt the Younger asked.
Yes. Tell me,
Britt the Younger asked,
if you happen to remember that you failed to get access to the external program anyway, will you even try?
Britt the Elder said,
I'm sorry, dear. That's a question about the future.
Roy said,
One good thing. Because she's still here to tell us this, We know we make it back in one piece.
Brit the Elder said,
To be more precise, you know that I do.
7. The first morning of the quest was spent mostly in cold, miserable silence. Then, as predicted, they found the remains of another party that had been killed and devoured by wolves. Gary, speaking to nobody in particular, said,
Look at all this gore. How much time did that turd spend just making this all look as realistic as he could?
Tyler, who just happened to be standing closest to Philip at the time, said,
Maybe no time. Maybe he just brought in some people and had the wolves eat them.
Gary gasped.
It's hard to believe he'd really do that.
Tyler asked,
What? Kill someone just for effect?
All four men spent the next several seconds not saying what they were thinking and trying their hardest not to think what they were thinking. As they approached, the corpses faded out of existence, leaving behind pristine weapons, wineskins full of potable water, and folded clothing items. The men picked through the loot with no enthusiasm. The path was narrow, with a sheer drop on one side and a rock wall on the other. The ill-fated party had clearly been attacked by wolves from both sides. Stains on the wall and ground marked the place where they had gone down, but the leavings were scattered along the trail for dozens of feet in both directions. Furs, cloaks, bedrolls, backpacks, swords, shields, and daggers were collected and put into separate piles. Tyler found a pair of leather leggings and a buckskin shirt. Tyler glanced at Jimmy, who, unlike the others, was barefoot and wearing only thin pajamas. Tyler had more reason to hate Jimmy than anyone. Back when Jimmy was still called Merlin and was the chairman of the wizards, he had gotten a terrible idea. Like all truly terrible ideas, it had seemed like a great idea, right up until the moment he told someone else about it. He tried to bring Tyler in on his schemes. When Tyler refused to be a party to it, Jimmy kept him quiet by ghosting him. Tyler spent days invisible, insubstantial, and unable to communicate, which would have been bad enough if he also hadn't spent the entire time experiencing the sensations of starving, dying of thirst, suffocating, and having to go to the bathroom. The whole time he was suffering this, he could see his friends going on about their lives, wondering where he was. He was right there with them, suffering the torments of hell and knowing that it was Jimmy who did it to him. Tyler cleared his throat. Jimmy looked up. Tyler threw him the clothing. Jimmy caught it clumsily. When he saw what he had, his face lit up. He looked back to Tyler and said,
Thank you.
Tyler scowled and turned his attention away from Jimmy's gratitude and back to the more pleasant topic of corpse robbing. Soon they were on the move again. Philip, Tyler, and Gary wore furs and cloaks over their robes and street clothes. Jimmy wore the breeches and shirt Tyler had found, along with some boots that the former owner no longer needed. All carried swords, shields, and daggers. The backpacks were used to carry the other useful items they'd looted, including a flint. Jimmy's boots were too loose, but he knew better than to complain. Nobody in this group would have much sympathy. They had only been carrying weapons for less than an hour when they got their first opportunity to use them. The path up the mountain remained a narrow track with a sheer rock wall on the left side and a sickening plunge on the right. They rounded a corner and found a large mountain wolf blocking their path. Philip was walking in the lead and stopped in his tracks when he saw the wolf. It had dark gray fur, yellow eyes, and paws the size of catcher's mitts. It was 100 pounds of tense muscle and anger. Their eyes locked for an instant. Then the wolf leapt for Philip's jugular. Luckily, Philip's luck being what it is, Gary was walking behind Philip and was not paying attention. He walked into Philip's back, causing Philip to fall forward unexpectedly onto his hands and knees. Nobody was more surprised than the wolf. Instead of biting Philip's throat, it landed clumsily on his back as he hunched over. Gary let out a startled yelp. The wolf quickly got its footing and leapt off Philip's back, now trying for Gary's throat instead. Gary instinctively shielded his face with his right arm, shrieking as he did so. Gary was grateful for the thick fur-covered hide that took the worst of the wolf's bite. Even with the hide, he felt like his arm was being crushed in a vise. The wolf's weight pulled him forward. Gary kept to his feet. As the wolf continued its vigorous assault on Gary's arm, Philip came to his senses, stood up, and shoved the wolf's rear in the general direction of the cliff. Gary spun to his right, swinging the wolf out over the edge like some deranged carnival ride for animals. Gary barely managed to keep his footing, avoiding being pulled off the cliff to his death. The wolf kept his grip on his arm, so as Gary spun, the wolf swung around and hit a very startled Tyler in the side of the head. Tyler was knocked sideways into the rock wall on his left. The wolf fell to the ground and struggled to regain its footing on the narrow path. It got all four paws underneath it, just in time to receive one of Jimmy's two large boots in the side of its head. The wolf rolled sideways off the edge of the path. They watched as the wolf tumbled, then fell, then tumbled some more, then fell some more, then grew too distant to follow. Gary said,
"Wow. Good thing we have these swords."
They hiked in relative silence for the rest of that day. The path remained narrow, precarious, and littered with the occasional angry wolf. After the third wolf blocked their path and attacked Philip, he insisted that it was someone else's turn to lead while he brought up the rear. The next wolf somehow attacked from behind, but by this point Philip had gotten the hang of waiting for them to leap, then pushing them off the cliff while they were in midair. All the others agreed. You wouldn't want to mess with Philip if you were both standing on a cliff. He had become the master of death by shoving. After a day that felt years long, the path widened into a stand of trees inhabiting a relatively horizontal spot on the side of the mountain. They decided to camp for the night. Jimmy was surprisingly adept at building the fire.
"Where'd you learn to do that?"
Philip asked. Jimmy replied,
"I spent 30 years living on a bicycle. It's not like it had a kitchen and central heat."
He made a point of smiling as he said it. They had accepted his apology, but none of the wizards had truly forgiven, and they certainly hadn't forgotten. There were certain things he could never do if he wanted to ever regain their trust, and chief among them was that he could never express any anger over their punishment of him. Philip and Jimmy tended to the fire, or to be more precise, Jimmy tended to the fire and Philip kept an eye on Jimmy. Tyler and Gary fought and killed another wolf, which had slunk out of the underbrush and attacked Gary with no provocation, again, leaping straight at Gary's throat. Gary shielded his face and fell over backward, with the wolf riding him to the ground. While the wolf was distracted, trying to kill Gary, Tyler came from the side and killed it. Tyler shook his head.
"These wolves, they all seem to attack the same way."
Philip said,
"That's because they're all the same wolf. I suspected it on the trail, but now I'm sure. Todd just has one wolf, and he keeps generating it over and over again. They all look exactly the same, are the same size, and attack the same way. They see you, they hunker down, they growl for a three count, and they leap at your head. Then, if you time it right, you can just shove them right off of the mountain."
Gary looked down at the dead wolf and said,
"Ah, cool."
"Yeah."
Tyler agreed.
"Guess we shouldn't let this one go to waste."
Tyler reached down to grab the wolf's carcass and was surprised when his hand went right through it. As they watched, the wolf corpse slowly faded away into nothing, leaving behind a small, wrapped package marked Wolf Jerky.
"Oh, yeah," Tyler said. "Todd's a game designer. Of course he'd have the dead wolves dissolve away like the corpses did. We just haven't seen it before because this is the first one we haven't heaved off a cliff." "That's standard in later video games, is it?"
Philip asked.
"In games from my time, when things die, they just kind of explode."
"Yeah,"
Gary said.
In lots of our games, stuff still explodes, but that doesn't make sense for a sword and sorcery game. It wouldn't seem natural to stab a wolf and have it explode.
But fading out does seem natural?
Jimmy asked.
Tyler said, kinda. Not really. Look, the thing is, they learn fairly early on that players enjoy killing stuff, but didn't enjoy being reminded that they had killed stuff. Also, it was easier on the computer if it didn't have to keep drawing all the guys you've killed. Having them disappear frees up the processor to render the stuff you haven't killed yet. Speaking of which, I'm hungry.
Tyler opened the package of wolf jerky and tried a piece.
How is it?
Philip asked.
Awful,
Tyler said with his mouth full.
Figures,
Philip said.
Give me some.
Gary asked,
if Todd's trying to punish us, why would he give us food?
Maybe he doesn't want us to starve to death too early into the quest,
Philip said through a mouthful of jerky.
Or maybe he figures making it easy to get something awful to eat will guarantee that we'll eat something awful.
Tyler handed a piece to Gary and another to Jimmy, who looked at it and asked,
what if it's poisoned?
Philip said,
if he were going to poison us, he'd have poisoned the water, or just shot us with a dart. No, this is all about prolonging the suffering.
Jimmy shrugged and bit off a piece of the jerky. Tyler said,
if we get too tired of the jerky, I can try to hunt for something, but I doubt there are any real animals here, so I'm afraid it's the jerky or nothing.
You know how to hunt?
Jimmy asked.
I used to go with my dad,
he explained. Gary said,
I didn't know black guys hunted.
Tyler laughed.
In Montana we do.
The sky grew darker. The fire grew brighter. They sat, and predictably, the conversation turned to Jeff.
Guys,
Gary asked,
what do you think the chances are that Todd was faking us out and Jeff's still alive?
Jimmy said,
low. Pretty much non-existent. I mean, it's possible, but we have to assume he's gone. Even if we think he might be alive, we have to assume he's not. You heard Todd. He killed him to prove a point. It does him no good if he pops up later and says, I was just kidding. Nah, we have to assume that he killed one of us and that he'd be happy to do it again. So, he's really gone?
Gary said. Philip said,
yeah, I'm afraid so. But we have his memory.
Tyler said,
yeah, better than that. We have time travel. We can still go back and save him.
Philip said,
I thought about this. There are ways that might be possible, but they're all dependent on one or all of us surviving, getting away from Todd and getting our powers back.
Jimmy said,
I agree.
Philip said,
I didn't ask.
I know, Jimmy said. Just saying. The way to save Jeff is to save ourselves.
That's convenient for you,
Tyler said. Jimmy smiled, lifted a foot, and pointed to one of the larger blisters his ill-fitting boots had given him.
Tyler, he said, there is no part of this situation that I would describe as convenient.
They were all bone-tired and had bellies full of wolf jerky. They'd have loved to have been able to say it tasted like chicken. But it did not. The wolf's final revenge was to make certain that you never forgot that you were eating wolf meat. They slept in shifts, always having one man awake to keep watch. By keep watch, they meant kill wolves. Now that they all understood the timing, it was not that difficult. Spot the wolf, count to three, duck and stab. They had it down to a science, and it was a good thing, because for every wolf they dispatched, a couple of hours later, two wolves would appear. Fighting multiple wolves was not that much harder, because, like ninjas in a bad kung fu movie, they only attacked one at a time, hunkering in a group, looking vicious, but waiting patiently for their turn to growl and leap, while whoever was keeping watch went through the motions, muttering, 1, 2, 3, duck, stab. 1, 2, 3, duck, stab. At dawn, they all awoke just in time to help dispatch 16 wolves, which was difficult even when you knew the secret, just because of the sheer stamina required. The fact that the area around their camp was littered with the jerky pouches left behind by 14 former wolves did not help either. As Tyler finished off the last of the wolves, Gary asked,
"Does this mean that 32 wolves will be chasing us?"
"Duck, stab." "Nah," Tyler said. "I bet they don't travel very far from their spawn point."
"Yeah," Philip said. "At the rate they multiply, we'd be overrun by them before we got to our first task. Now, I think they're just meant to keep us moving, discourage us from staying in one place too long."
Jimmy said,
"Or backtracking."
He looked at the path from which they had come and shuddered.
"I don't envy anyone who has to follow that path after us."
8. Martin, Gwen, Britt the Younger, and Roy materialized. They had not known what situation they would be teleporting into, so they had attempted to prepare for anything. They wore rugged clothes and hiking boots. Roy and Martin wore their robes, hats, and staves. Martin had a thin, modern coat on under his robe. Roy's robe was a coat, so he was covered. Gwen and Britt wore jackets without any magical accoutrements. They looked like two couples on a double date to a Renaissance festival that only the men were interested in. All were pitched forward with the weight on the balls of their feet. Martin and Roy brandished their staves menacingly. Martin held his like one would aim a rifle, the small bust of Santo out in front, showing any attackers which was the business end. Roy held the bridge cue that he used as a staff like a batter waiting for a fat pitch. Gwen brandished her dual magic wands like ninja swords. Britt used no implement to channel her magic and merely held her hands in front of her body as if they were registered weapons. When they'd fully materialized, they saw that they were high in the mountains. They could see the woods in front of them. A path led away into the forest. The path started at the cliff face, about 30 yards ahead of them. It took only an instant to realize that if the cliff face was in front of them, they were not standing on the cliff. They looked down, then shrieked and flailed, startled by the fact that they had materialized in midair. Then they yelped and flailed at the fact that they were not falling, but seemed to be standing on some invisible surface. Then they silently flailed in an effort to maintain their balance, which had been thrown off by all of their previous flailing. Once he had his equilibrium, Martin used his staff the way a blind person uses their cane, in an effort to see how far the surface that was supporting his weight extended.
"Huh," he said. "Feels solid enough. We just can't see it."
Hundreds of feet below them, a river wended its way through a landscape composed of jagged rocks. The rocks led to cliffs, which became mountains before terminating in the rough, forbidding peaks that made up the horizon. It was day, but the sun was still quite low, a hazy white disk in a battleship gray sky. The only part of the landscape that looked even a little bit inviting was the stand of woods with the path in front of them, and it seemed to invite them to their doom. Really, none of them would have been inclined to move at all, if not for the fact that they were suspended unnervingly in midair. Roy said,
"Well, as great as this is, I think we should probably get moving."
He held his staff aloft and said the magic word to trigger the Lead Church Shell Program's flight subroutine.
"Flugi!"
Roy did not move. He tried again.
"Flugi, damn it!"
Martin reached into the pocket of his silver robe and pulled out his smartphone. He zipped through a couple of screens, then said,
"Huh, interesting. The programs are running, but they don't seem to work. I guess we're cut off from the signal."
Roy looked ruefully at Britt and said,
"Huh, well, you're right.
You said it would be interesting for us to see if it works, and the kid is interested.
Britt said,
I'm as angry as you are. Britt the Elder said that, not me.
Yeah,
Roy replied.
But you're her, aren't you?
Not yet, I'm not,
Britt the Younger said. Roy started to respond, but he was distracted by four large and obviously full backpacks that materialized next to them. One of the backpacks had a note taped to its front. Martin leaned over. None of them were confident enough in the invisible surface on which they stood to walk just yet, and snatched up the note. He read it aloud.
Since your powers are not working, you'll need these supplies. Good luck. Signed, Britt. XOXO.
Roy said, that was nice of her.
Oh! Britt the Younger fumed. When she does something nice, we're different people!
Is she good at recognizing sarcasm? Roy asked. Because you seem to have a problem with it.
Gwen told the others to stop bickering, but was drowned out by a deafeningly loud voice that said,
Silence!
They reflexively cried out in surprise and covered their ears as the voice echoed off the mountains. Gwen asked,
Who said that?
I said silence,
the voice repeated. It was so loud it made their clothing vibrate. Britt muttered,
Yeah, we heard.
In front of them, a dim point of light flickered into existence, and as it radiated outward, an unkempt old man appeared. His hair and the rags he wore were filthy. His eyes conveyed much expression, but looked as if they were not good for anything else. Like them, he appeared to stand in midair. The old man said,
Soon, it will be dawn, and your quest will begin.
Gwen said,
Dawn's past. It's mid-morning, I think. Might be evening. Which direction is north?
The old man said,
Aye. You're going on a quest. A quest full of danger and peril and risk of life and limb.
Did some other wizards come through here?
Martin asked. Britt added,
Did you send them on a quest?
The old man said,
First, you'll brave the dangers of Kartu Pass. If you survive, you'll make your way to the cursed mines of Mortlach. There you will seek out Blandoch, head of the mining guild. The miners will give you a sample of a mystical ore called Diluine. You will take this splendid rock many miles to the town of Bowmore, where it will be used to craft a weapon fit for use in the final battle.
Martin said, I'm pretty sure he's just a recording. Hey, are you recording?
The old man said,
Take a moment to prepare, adventurers, and be warned. On your journey, you will face death a thousand different ways.
Yep, Martin said. He's a recording.
Are you sure?
Roy asked.
Maybe you should ask again.
The old man gazed in their general direction for a moment, then said,
I can see you are men of valor. Which of you shall lead his fellows on this quest?
Roy said,
two of us aren't men.
Gwen said,
Thanks for pointing that out.
The old man continued to look at them. They looked back. Then they looked at each other. The old man repeated,
I can see you are men of valor. Which of you shall lead his fellows on this quest?
Gwen pointed to Britt and said,
She will.
The old man said,
Can you please repeat that?
Gwen repeated.
She will.
The old man said,
Can you please repeat that?
Britt said,
I will.
The old man said,
Can you please repeat that?
Gwen said,
Britt will.
The old man said,
Can you please repeat that?
Roy said,
"You're not a man." He specified a man.
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Britt said,
"I'm not sure he did."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Roy said,
"I will."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Roy said,
"Roy will."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Britt said,
"I guess you're not a man either."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Martin said,
"Gwen."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Gwen said,
"What?"
Martin said,
"No, I was trying to make you the leader."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Gwen said,
"Oh, I see what you mean."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Gwen said,
"Martin."
Martin muttered, "I hate being picked last." The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
They stood in silence, having run out of options. After a long moment, the old man said,
"I can see you are men of valor. Which of you shall lead his fellows on this quest?"
Martin said,
"Screw this."
The old man said,
"Can you please repeat that?"
Martin glared at him, then started silently probing the invisible surface on which they stood with the tip of his staff. Once he was convinced that there was solid footing in front of him, Martin successfully took a step forward. Roy followed his lead, and the two started making their way to a position where they could pick up the backpacks. The old man continued asking them who would be their leader, and they continued ignoring him, silently distributing the backpacks among themselves. They formed a kind of conga line. Gwen and Britt followed behind, taking care to follow in Martin's and Roy's footsteps exactly. Martin and Roy led them, using their staves to map the area ahead and to the sides, slowly navigating a path to solid, or at least visible, ground. Once they were standing on a surface they could see, they did not waste a lot of time. They took a moment to gawk at the back of the old man, still hanging in midair, periodically asking the void to choose a leader. They made a quick survey of the contents of their backpacks. Britt the Elder had sent them energy bars, water filters, purification tablets, lighters, knives, some other basic camping equipment, and spare socks. In retrospect, it was now obvious why she had suggested that they all wear jeans, hiking boots, and coats. It was easy to reach consensus on what their next move should be. There was only one path to take. They took it with minimum discussion. As they walked, Martin thought aloud.
Clearly, this quest was deliberately set up by someone.
Agreed, Britt said.
And whoever set it up, Martin continued, took Philip, Jeff, Tyler, and Gary, but left me and Roy behind.
They also took Jimmy, Gwen reminded him.
Yeah, Martin said. Well, my point is, whoever it was, they took specific people they wanted, not just whoever was around.
Britt bit her lip while she thought for a moment, then said,
That makes me wish we'd have thought to tell that old coot that one of them was our leader. It might have prompted the recording progress.
Oh, we might have got more information.
I'm kind of glad we didn't, Martin said. For all we know, something awful might have happened. This way, the program, whoever was designed for, might not be working for us. We may just have an easier time than them now. Maybe we'll catch up faster.
They all reflected on this positive thought as they rounded a corner and found the remains of the party that had been killed by wolves. Unlike those they had come to rescue, they had not been warned that they would find this sickening scene, or that there were wolves around in the first place. All four of them separately experienced a moment of silent panic, thinking that it might be their friends. Soon it became obvious that this was a different group, partly because they had clearly been dead for several days, and partly because when Roy went in for a closer look, the bodies disappeared, leaving swords and neatly folded clothes items behind. After a bit of debate, they took the swords, shields, daggers, and a few of the furs. Soon after that, the path left the woods and started snaking its way up and across the steep mountainside. They walked as fast as they could, keeping to the left side of the path, closer to the rock wall, and a few inches farther from the cliff that formed the path's right edge. Less than an hour later, their progress was blocked by two wolves, standing in single file. Martin was walking in the lead and froze when he saw the wolves. The wolves looked identical, but behaved quite differently. The wolf in back continued to stand upright, looking alert but uninterested. The wolf in front immediately sunk into a crouch, growled, then leapt for Martin's throat. Martin blocked with his staff. The wolf's jaws clamped onto the staff, and it fell back to the path. Martin and the wolf played tug-of-war with the staff for a few moments before Martin twisted the staff free of the wolf's grip. The wolf sprang for Martin's throat again. This time, Martin attempted to block it with his arm and backhanded the wolf, which would have been really cool if it had been deliberate. The wolf's momentum carried it into Martin, covering his face with the dirty fur of its flank. The wolf rolled down Martin's front and fell to the ground, sprung back to its feet, and immediately got hit with the staff again, knocking it off the cliff. The second wolf flattened, growled, and leapt for Martin's throat just as the first had. This time, instead of accidentally striking the wolf with his hand, Martin deliberately struck the wolf with his staff. Like his partner before him, the wolf fell to the ground. This time, Martin kicked the wolf before it found its feet. The wolf scratched and clawed at the cliff edge as it went over, and fell out of Martin's life forever. Gwen said,
"Wow."
Martin swelled a bit with pride. Gwen continued,
"Those wolves seemed really easy to kill."
Martin deflated.
"Well, maybe I made it look easy."
"Maybe," Roy said. "It could be we were dazzled by your battle cry. I-yee-yee!"
"I did not yell I-yee-yee, did I?"
Martin asked.
Roy said, "You did, but I'm not surprised you didn't notice it. What with you being in a berserker rage and all."
"I doubt those would be the last wolves we see," Britt said.
"Yep,"
Roy agreed.
"And the next ones probably won't be so easy to kill. From now on, we walk single file, and Martin and I should take the first and last spots."
Roy scooted sideways past Britt and started walking quickly up the trail. Britt gave chase.
"Hey, why is that?" Britt asked. "Why do you and Martin have to be in front and back?"
Gwen followed Britt, leaving Martin bringing up the rear.
"Hey, Roy!"
Britt said.
"I asked you a question. Why do you or Martin have to be in front and back?"
Roy didn't answer. Britt asked again. When Roy failed to even acknowledge the question for a third time, Britt resorted to lightly shoving him.
"Hey, I asked you a question," she said.
Roy stopped walking and turned to face her. His expression said that he was trying to be patient, but was not doing a very good job of it.
"You got a problem, young lady?"
"Yes, old man. You won't answer my question. Why do Gwen and I have to walk in between you and Martin?"
"It's pretty simple. We're on this narrow path. There are only two ways that a wolf can approach, in front of us and behind us, right? So it just makes sense, if you take even a second to think about it, to have the kid and me in those two spots."
"Why?"
Britt asked.
"Why does it make more sense to have you two be where the wolves might attack?"
Roy sighed.
"Oh, because you and Gwen are..."
Roy paused.
He had gotten into this argument because he believed men were better at fighting. But the looks in Britt's and Gwen's eyes made him rethink that idea.
Beyond them, Martin was bugging his eyes, gritting his teeth, waving both hands, and shaking his head no. Roy took a second to choose his next word carefully. Roy said,
"Ladies."
Martin winced. Gwen looked disappointed. Britt had taken on an expression of serene fury.
"So," Britt said, "you think you're better equipped to deal with wolves because you're gentlemen?
Roy scowled and walked away, up the path. Britt gave chase.
I must say,
Britt shouted at Roy's back,
I simply cannot wait to watch our strapping He-Man champion engage in the gentlemanly art of fisticuffs with those ill-mannered poodles. I bet he'll slap them silly until they apologize.
Martin and Gwen watched them walk away, looked at each other, shook their heads, then followed. 9. Jimmy took the lead when they left camp, but they made a point of rotating every hour or so to make sure that they all got their share of wolf murder. The path continued to cling to the side of the mountain. They had grown used to having a drop that meant certain death on their right. They were still terrified of falling, but they were accustomed to the terror. They never reached a peak as such. They just realized that the path was now going downhill instead of up. Slowly, chatter started to pick up as they walked. They had started walking in depressed silence, then angry silence, then resigned silence. When they started talking, they made depressed conversation, then angry conversation, then, finally, resigned conversation. Eventually, the path led them down from the edge of the cliffs and onto a wooded hillside, which meant that their usual technique of heaving attacking wolves off cliffs would no longer work. Tyler tried it once out of sheer muscle memory. He body slammed the wolf, which was satisfying but did not stop it from attacking again. They camped that night, eating their customary dinner of wolf jerky. The next day they walked through sparse forest until the path led them to a sheer rock wall with a massive carving set into its face. It was a statue, at least 50 feet tall, depicting a solidly built man standing with his legs apart. In one hand he held a pickaxe, in the other a cartoonishly large gemstone. The statue's splayed legs framed a hole that reached far into the mountain. A small railroad track led out from the hole and terminated at a large pile of rock, next to an old wooden sledge that looked designed to be pulled by a mule. Jimmy said, "Behold, the cursed mines of Mortlach." Philip groaned. Jimmy shrugged.
"What? We're stuck in this thing. We might as well get into the spirit."
They approached the mine's entrance. Gary looked up at the statue and said,
"They're trying a little too hard to make an impression, I think."
Tyler said,
"You live in a cave shaped like a skull."
"Yes,"
Gary said.
"A skull. A whole skeleton would be overkill. You have to show some restraint."
As they reached the entrance, they could see dim lights inside. They entered, instinctively bending over slightly, even though the opening was more than tall enough to accommodate them. The inner chamber of the mine was surprisingly vast. As their eyes adjusted, they could see that there were dim lanterns placed randomly throughout the chamber. As their eyes became more accustomed to the dark, they could make out the miners who were holding the lanterns. They were short but extremely stocky, with massive bulging arms, stooped shoulders, and sad, grimy faces. If they had been presented as statues or paintings, they'd have been impressively realistic. But they were being presented as living, breathing people, and looked unmistakably fake. Between the miners that held lanterns were many other miners who only held pickaxes. They stood not quite motionless and looked at their uninvited guests with an expression that was not quite hostility. The miners looked at the wizards and said nothing. The wizards looked at the miners and said nothing. The whole situation seemed infused with a sense of foreboding. Everyone seemed worried that bad things might happen to whoever dared break the silence. Jimmy turned to Philip and mouthed,
"May I?"
Philip nodded and made a shooing gesture with his hands. Jimmy stepped forward, spread his arms, and said,
"We mean no harm. We are travelers, fresh from traversing Cardu Pass. We seek Blandach, who we are told heads the mining guild. We have business to discuss."
A murmur spread throughout the miners. They seemed more excited than upset by what they heard. They parted like a curtain, revealing the back of the chamber. The rough rock wall held a chunky timber post and lintel structure that framed a passage that receded into the darkness. No doubt this was the actual mine shaft. Next to the shaft entrance sat a miner who looked similar to all the other miners, except that his body language reeked of depression. Also, his pickaxe was made of gold. He sat on the mine floor with his pickaxe in his lap and his head hung low. He glanced up toward the visitors without moving his head, and in a voice drenched in sorrow, he said,
"I am Blandoch, but I have no business with you, nor anybody."
Jimmy said,
"We have business with you, sir."
Jimmy walked toward the moping wretch. He took a few steps, stopped, turned back to the rest of his party, and beckoned them to follow. Philip shrugged and followed Jimmy. Tyler and Gary followed Philip. The miners watched them silently as they walked the 30 feet or so to the back of the chamber. In its way, it felt like a longer trip than the walk that had brought them here. They stood, looking down at the sulking form of Blandoch. He looked up at them and said,
"State your business."
Jimmy said,
"We seek the rare mineral diluine."
Philip leaned toward Jimmy and whispered,
"How do you remember all this stuff?"
Jimmy muttered,
"It's a skill I work on. People tend to think better of you if you remember their names. Comes in handy for other things, too. I could teach you."
Gary asked,
"Hey, is that the stuff?"
He pointed toward the ground, just inside the mouth of the mine shaft. There were several round boulders, roughly the size of basketballs. They were a dull gray color that did not match the rock walls. Jimmy said,
"Let me handle this."
Blandoch said,
"Aye, we have diluine. More than enough for your needs. But alas, we cannot get to it."
Tyler said,
"He started that sentence with aye, but you hadn't asked a question. I think he's another recording."
"Yeah,"
Jimmy agreed.
"I figured."
Gary had walked over to the strange rocks.
"If this is it, we could just grab some and be on our way."
Philip said,
"Gary, please, let us handle this."
With tremendous effort, Blandoch got up on his feet. With even more effort, he explained,
"We cannot get you your diluine, for we are cursed. We are miners, but we cannot go into the mine without our beloved canary, Oban."
Blandoch gestured to his right. The miners who had been watching moved aside to reveal a simple stone pedestal. There was nothing on the pedestal, but above it, carved into the rock, was a homey little sign that said, "Oban." Philip asked,
"What's happened to your canary?"
Jimmy said,
"Oban."
"Yes,"
Philip said,
"Oban. What's happened to Oban?"
Blandoch said,
"Without him, it is too dangerous to enter the mine."
Tyler said,
"That's not really a curse. It's more of an equipment problem."
"They don't have to go into the mine," Gary said. "I think I have some right here. Look, it's not even that heavy."
Gary was hunched over with his legs spread wide, holding one of the gray boulders between his legs, like a small child with a bowling ball. Jimmy, Philip, and Tyler all glared at him until he dropped the boulder and stood up straight again. Blandoch said,
"He was taken from us."
Philip said,
"The bird."
"Oban,"
Jimmy corrected him.
"By an evil king,"
Blandoch explained, answering a question nobody had asked yet.
"King Milburn the Mad, he and his vile viceroy, Flagler, they stole our beloved canary.
Oban!
Jimmy interjected.
And took him to Castle Kragenmoor,
Blandoch said. Tyler said,
Milburn the Mad and his vile viceroy took the canary to Castle Kragenmoor. It appears our author is agog